Hello and welcome to Shadow Talk, an information security podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest Photon Research Team. My name is Chris, and this week I'm joined by three of my colleagues. First up, we have one of the CISOs at ReliaQuest, Rick Holland. How are you, Rick?
Good. Good to be here.
Excellent. We're also joined by Ivan. How are you, Ivan?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. And also from the wider family here at ReliaQuest, we have Brandon Tirado, who's the manager of the threats hunting team here at ReliaQuest. Thanks for joining, Brandon. How are you?
Doing good, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. And just as a heads up to our listeners, we will be having a different roster of people joining Shadow Talk as part of our integration into ReliaQuest. So expect to hear a number of new voices, and I think importantly, a number of new perspectives as well in the coming weeks. So all good stuff to come in the coming weeks and months. So just to round up a few incidents and events that have taken place in the last week before we get on to our three designated topics. So first up, Microsoft have announced on Tuesday a new version of its Bing search engine that's powered by a next generation OpenAI language model that reportedly is more powerful than ChatGPT and specifically trained for web search. So you might have heard several of our other podcasts talking about ChatGPT and how much AI tech is going to change the way in which people search for information. And of course, this could also be exploited for use by threat actors. So unsurprising to see how quickly the space is moving. And of course, Microsoft are on top of this, as you would expect. We've also seen reporting on scammers exploiting the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Turkey and Syria, this time stealing donations.
It's the worst, right? You have that absolute devastation there. Sorry,
it's just awful people.
I hate these people, things. Man.
Yeah, they're really terrible. A lot of things that they're doing, but you know, stealing donations by abusing platforms like PayPal and Twitter. You know, and as you would expect, a lot of government businesses and charity organizations are really stepping up to raise funds and aid victims of this disaster. And of course, as you would expect, threat actors are also wasting no time in targeting unsuspecting donors by introducing scam websites. So I think the takeaway for me here is if you do want to contribute monetarily to the people that are affected by this catastrophe, you know, make sure to do your due diligence and kind of research before committing money. I always suggest going through trusted web browsers, search engines, and kind of identifying known and trusted charities that are participating in this. So in the UK, there's the likes of the British Red Cross, Oxfam. Can you think of any that would be specific to the US, Rick or Brandon? Of course, Ivan on the call.
Red Cross, and then, of course, Red Crescent in the Middle East as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there's several others, you know, that are trusted and specific to where our listeners are based. But, you know, just do your due diligence, really. So the first topic today is related to Killnet, which is a pro-Russian hacktivist group that really came to life in 2022, committing several attacks against prominent targets in support of Russia's war against Ukraine. So recently, off the top of my head, they were targeting several financial institutions in the West, the EU Parliament, you know, several other kind of high-profile targets. And in the last week, they were noted to be targeting US healthcare facilities, which again is about as low as you can get, really. Although new reporting has suggested that fewer than half of these distributed denial of service attacks that are launched by this group actually successfully disrupted hospital websites. So Ivan, could you provide us with an overview of Killnet? You know, what are their motivations and what are their kind of origins?
Yeah, sure. So Killnet, they are, like you said, a pro Russia hacktivist group. They emerged around January of 2022. And basically, what they were a provider of a DDoS tool called Killnet prior to the Russia-Ukraine war. And then when the Russia-Ukraine war started, they kind of shifted their tactics. And instead of providing the tool, they took that tool offline. And then they began conducting DDoS attacks themselves on behalf of Russia in support of Russia. They're not the Russia government. They're not working for the Russian government, but they are in support of the Russian government. And they mainly target NATO countries and organizations that are in critical sectors within those countries. They frequently target financial services, government websites, healthcare, transportation, and they mainly want to cause as much damage as they can to these countries because they feel like these countries are causing aggression towards Russia, and they want to retaliate against those countries. So they're doing a lot of DDoS attacks on websites, and they frequently post, let's say, a list of victims, and then they invite other supporters to join in on these attacks. And they've been doing this since, May of 2022. And like you said, most recently, their most recent campaign was that they were targeting U.S. and European healthcare sectors. And they targeted more than 50 organizations and healthcare websites.
So going after healthcare providers is very much in the MO, their kind of usual targeting that they would typically do. Interesting that you mentioned about kind of crowdfunding hacktivism as well. I think that was kind of one of the developments from last year, going internationally and looking for support in your hacktivist activity. A question for you all, would you say that KillNet are more of a nuisance, or are they actually a serious threat?
I think there's a danger. There's a danger and in fact, I was kind of in this camp a little bit, if I'm honest, in October, because in October they targeted some of the airport websites. Excuse me. They're just kind of like an annoying gnat, or just kind of things that you've heard about them. In fact, CISA just this week said that KillNet had little effect, several reduced availability of sites, no reports of unauthorized access to networks, disruption to healthcare delivery, or impacts on patient safety. But I do think that kind of underplays what's going on. Like, if you're just think about our listeners here, if you're in an IT shop, security team, a web developer that's supposed to maintain, the main landing page for your hospital system, and it goes down, I'd say that's not little effect. So I think it's easy to Monday morning quarterback and say this had little effect, unless you're the ones in the trenches having to respond to these. In fact, we raised our, Ivan did this in some reporting for us this week. We raised our threat assessment of KillNet from a low risk to a medium risk, just because of their increased activity, and they can cause problems. I think a key takeaway here is, have a tabletop exercise on a DDoS attack. Rotate. I'm sure probably a lot of our listeners, we always talk about doing ransomware tabletops and stuff like that. I would do a DDoS tabletop and see, what can your firewalls are generally not going to be enough. If you're just relying on your firewalls or load balancers, they're probably not going to make it very well. You're going to probably want to have at least evaluate a scrubbing service, Akamai, whatever the case may be. There's a lot of cloud-based services, but I would recommend you do a tabletop exercise in your next evolution of those and see how resilient you are to these types of attacks.
Good stuff. And interesting to note that kind of change in threat level that we put. I would absolutely agree with that. I think, it's a bit dangerous to suggest that they are a low threat, given that they're targeting critical infrastructure and hospitals. And we've all been in a hospital, right? We understand that the waiting times can often be longer than you actually want. Even the smallest kind of IT headache can cause a serious problem, I would imagine. So I wouldn't suggest that they are a nuisance or a low threat. What was that phrase you just used there, Rick? Was it Sunday morning quarterback? I'm trying to think of a UK.
Monday morning quarterback.
Monday morning quarterback. Good stuff. I remember that one. How do you anticipate the role of hacktivists in the actual ongoing war in 2023?
I think the hacktivism is definitely one of the ways that the people are finding that they can aid with the war without getting involved in the physical confrontation. We have seen hacktivism happening from the Russia side with KillNet, and we have also seen it from Ukraine with the IT Army of Ukraine. Hacktivism has been pretty popular. They're mainly doing DDoS attacks, trying website defacements and those types of attacks. But like you guys mentioned, it can have some serious consequences. It kind of reminds me of when we had a ransomware attack on a hospital in Germany a long time ago, I think it was last year, and somebody died because of it, because they were not able to access their their internal resources, and then they had to transport the patients to another hospital, and then they ended up not making it. So it can have some very serious consequences if services are being taken down on websites for like hospital healthcare. So yeah, there's definitely a way that they can contribute to the war and have some serious effects.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point too. Like, you know, that ransomware case, and I know, like, the, I think it's the Irish Health Service services was you know, attacked by Conti as well. But you know, something that hits a little bit closer to home for me is I went to school at Florida State University, and I just saw that the Tallahassee Memorial Hospital this week suffered a ransomware incident, and obviously the availability that came with it. You know, they were, you know, deterring emergency services to other hospitals and whatnot. And, you know, with what we've seen with KillNet and their recent campaign of like targeting healthcare service providers, you know, that could really, really have an impact that goes further beyond just services being unavailable, you know, dealing with the livelihood of individuals that need critical services. So definitely worth keeping an eye out for.
Yeah, something that I think maybe we kind of get ransomware fatigue to a certain extent because we deal with this on a daily basis. But there is, you know, that tipping point of a threat to data, which is obviously incredibly serious, but also where it goes over to that threat to life, you know, that kind of goes up a different level. So that's what these groups are, I wouldn't say aiming to achieve, but they, by committing to their activity, they absolutely could put someone's life in danger. So it's always worth considering, I think. We'll move on to the next topic of the day, which also is in the world of ransomware. So many administrators, hosting providers, and also the French Computer Emergency Response Team, so CERT-FR, this week have warned that attackers are actively targeting VMware ESXi servers that are unpatched against a two-year-old remote code execution vulnerability to deploy a new type of ransomware that's known as ESXi ARGs. The vulnerability is tracked as CVE-2021-21974, and this security flaw is caused by a heap overflow.
Wait a minute,
issue.
Did you say 2021? That's important. Yes, that is important, right?
Absolutely. Well, it's 2 years old. Of course, that's not new, is it? You know, let's be honest. The old vulnerabilities are often the ones that are most commonly targeted. But yeah, this is a heap overflow issue in OpenSLP that can be exploited by unauthenticated threat actors in a relatively low complexity attack. So first question to you, Brandon, is VMware ESXi commonly targeted by such actors, and what makes them such a susceptible and exploitable piece of equipment?
Yeah, no, great question. You know, we've seen throughout the last couple of years, like many intrusions that have led to ransomware, starting with ESXi hosts. And, you know, unfortunately, they're sometimes accessible to the internet. And as a result, you know, something with a CVE that's 2 years old that is, you know, allowing for an RCE, these are very, 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 targets in mind for threat actors, just based on their relationships with the environment. You know, similar to, you know, a domain controller, you know, they have kind of a one-to-many relationship. So if I can get on an ESXi host, whether that's direct access to the ESXi host or a management console like vSetter, you can create a lot of havoc. And, you know, kind of just go to the ESXi server and any, you know, virtual machines that the ESXi server is kind of running, you can kind of push a payload at scale. And that's kind of what we saw here. You know, last time I checked, it was like 3,800 compromises over the weekend that CISA had reported on for, you know, this particular campaign. And, you know, it looks like the operators in this case saw some great success as far as like getting their payloads and infecting machines. So it's kind of like a prey and spray, if you will. They took full advantage of what it is that they found and exploited it at scale.
And 3,800 in a relatively short space of time as well, I think is the key here. It happened over a matter of days, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, you're saying this is an old vulnerability. I mean, would you even classify a 2-year vulnerability as old in the grand scheme of things? I mean,
Laughs maybe not the right word, but it's like my initial reaction already is like only 2 years old, because we do see exploitation of much older vulnerabilities that have, you know, patches out there for it. 2 years. I mean, like if you're not patching something in weeks, you know, months, okay, maybe there's a little bit that you could see for that, but you know, 2 years is again, but I'm Monday morning quarterbacking these organizations that are doing it. You know, I'm doing that myself right now, but 2 years, you should have hopefully not be running these on public facing internet. Just like the same thing we talk about with RDP and all the other different things that initial access brokers go after.
Yeah. If it's like if it's an RCE in particular, and especially if you have the endpoint configured to be publicly accessible from the internet, it's kind of just inevitable, like when it's going to be exploited. You know, in this case, you know, it's a 2-year-old vulnerability. I'm sure there's been compromises that have led, you know, that started with this, but, you know, in this case, at the particular scale and the impact that this had in this particular campaign is kind of why I think we're getting the attention on it now.
Well, it's actually a good point you make, Brandon. Like, if someone has been a victim and this was the attack vector, it's safe. I'd say it's probably, I could make a, you know, a safe assessment that other actors may have taken advantage of this over the past 2 years. And you might, while you're doing your IR work, to the extent that you might have logs going back 2 years, I wouldn't just think of this as an isolated event that just happened in the past week. I would go further back, much further back.
Yeah, there's probably a chest of horrors that are waiting to be found associated to this particular vulnerability, I imagine. What kind of details do we actually know about CVE-2021-21974? Obviously, this is quite an older one, but what details do we know about this particular vulnerability?
So this vulnerability, it was discovered back in February of it was discovered back in 2021, and they released a patch in February of 2021. It's a CVSS score of 8.8. And there were not a ton of reports of exploitation of this vulnerability prior to these attacks, but there were POCs out there. So like Brandon mentioned, you know, it's only a matter of time when it's been 2 years since the patch has been released. There's POCs, you know, that. And these are the types of vulnerabilities that threat actors like exploiting when they're attack. So it's really not surprising that we're seeing this type of exploitation. What is slightly surprising is that, you know, we have all these public-facing servers that out there are still vulnerable. And unfortunately, that's what happens when these types of patches are not applied.
Absolutely. What do we know of the actual ransomware targeting these devices, Ivan? It's kind of a new one to me. I'd not seen this reference before this campaign.
Yeah, so the name of the ransomware group, they're called ESXi ARGs, and they apparently demanded $50,000 in Bitcoin from victims. They also threatened to expose information to the public if the victims didn't pay the ransom, but there were actually a lot of doubts about whether they stole any data from their attacks. And it's really unlikely given the magnitude of the attacks. They allegedly targeted 3,800 victims in 2 days, and they just wouldn't have the resources to steal data from all those victims so quickly. And the group does not have a data leakage website at the moment. There's still a lot of unknown regarding this ransomware group. They're very opportunistic, and they didn't really have time to check, let's say, the victim size, the revenue, and the type of data that they stole prior to them giving a ransom. This was just a widespread and indiscriminate attack. So I wouldn't really be surprised if we never hear about this group again after this.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's just very different to what we usually see from ransomware activity, which is obviously usually incredibly targeted. So not done to specifically go after one company. It's just like Brandon was saying, kind of spray and pray done en masse. Opportunistically, and I would imagine there's less chance to actually receive ransom payments, but you know, I imagine there'd be some victims who would unfortunately be forced to actually pay.
That's a good note though. But like, I just want to shout out like CISA and, you know, I know the French cert team, and I think there was a security researcher, you know, they kind of quickly assembled and came out with like a batch crypt that can be used to kind of help recover, you know, victims.
Yeah, I was about to mention that. I've got the CISA alert up on it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that, like, I think the timing is what I'm really, really excited about, is like how fast we kind of assembled as a community to get something out there, you know, to those victims. And, you know, it essentially, the way they were encrypting, there's opportunity to kind of reconstruct the virtual machine's metadata to kind of unencrypt the VMs that were encrypted. So again, shout out to CISA and, you know, the French CERT team and others involved on that front, because that's definitely going to, you know, help with victims that are in that ballpark of whether or not do we pay, whether do we have backups, et cetera. It's another, have another option available to them. So
I will say, and we're recording this Thursday morning US time, as of last night, I saw reports that it was maybe subsequent attacks that the recovery script wasn't effective for. So I don't know when this publishes on Friday, what the situation will be, but if you're looking at that recovery script as an option, I would definitely do some Googling out there to see whatever the latest news is over the weekend, as far as efficacy of that goes. There's a, you know, kind of was reading, it's a different strand of the malware that perhaps, you know, took care of the fix that this had. But yeah, that was kind of breaking news last night. So I would definitely do some Googling for the latest on that by the time this comes out.
And other than the kind of recovery script we just mentioned there, and obviously patching the vulnerability, what do you think organizations should actually be doing in addition to those kind of two mitigative steps, Brandon?
Yeah, so obviously, like I had mentioned earlier, like, These endpoints, whether it be the ESXi server itself or, you know, a management console like vCenter, creating, you know, network controls so that they're not publicly accessible to the internet. For whatever reason, if, you know, that's a risk that your organization, you know, takes on and can't, you know, build those controls, at least permitting some type of, you know, ACL policy to allow traffic from known IPs or, you know, known good IPs that can interact with those assets. But one thing, you know, obviously, as we've seen through time, that these types of devices are targeted because of their one-to-many relationship. A lot of people don't take into consideration that the operating system, excuse me, that vCenter is running, it's called VM kernel. People kind of think that it's actually a Linux distribution, but it's not. It's its own operating system. And, you know, most of the major EDR players in the game, they don't compile like agent binaries for this particular, you know, operating system. It's typically, you know, Linux or Windows or Mac OS. So having an asset like this publicly accessible with, you know, not having coverage via an EDR technology is going to be kind of a recipe for disaster. So
it's such a good point.
Yeah. So making sure that as a result of that, you can kind of set up some type of forwarding to a central logging platform like a SIM to send that telemetry in to, you know, prompt detection, prompt response to, you know, hopefully mitigate the dwell time and, you know, combat impact that's going to be seen as a result of an intrusion.
I mean, it's hard enough to get coverage on Linux in general. You know, certain versions of Ubuntu, certain kernels, new kernel update comes out, you know, your EDR solution doesn't work. Had a little experience trying to defend Linux environments in my career. So yeah, definitely knowing what's under these appliances, if you have the vendors running them, and how quickly they update them. But again, like, if it's public facing, put some of these mitigations in, you know, ACLs, restrictions and stuff that Brandon alluded to try to minimize the risk there.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's really, really comprehensive, Brandon. I really appreciate that. Some absolutely fantastic advice there. I'm going to keep you on the spot, though. Keep you on the hook just for a little bit longer. So we'll move on to the last item for today. And that's on a recent blog we put together on a campaign that was actually, you know, been worked on by Brandon and his team. here at ReliaQuest, detailing a campaign we've observed related to Sock Ghoulish. Am I right in saying that, Brandon? Sock Ghoulish or Sock Ghoulish?
Sock Ghoulish. I pronounce it Sock Ghoulish. It's kind of like Revel, Revel. There's different ways of pronouncing it. I just go by Sock Ghoulish.
We'll go with Ghoulish. There's probably many listeners who will be screaming at their devices for many of the pronunciations I've given over the years, but we'll go with Ghoulish. So Sock Ghoulish, also known as Fake Updates, which is a malware distribution framework that's often used to facilitate various forms of cybercrime. So given your team headed up in the effort investigating this campaign, could you tell our listeners a little more about, you know, who's behind this or what is the Sock Ghoulish campaign all about?
Yeah, so I guess I'll just do a quick little intro on Sock Ghoulish. So, you know, Chris, as you had mentioned, Sock Ghoulish starts with a legitimate site that has been compromised. It's usually an insecure content management system like WordPress, where an adversary will inject malicious JavaScript code onto the site. The injected JavaScript uses what's called a traffic direction system, which essentially provides guardrails for the operators and their infrastructure. So the JavaScript will only load if, you know, visitors to that compromised site meet certain requirements. So things of like IP addresses, user agents, cookies, et cetera. And again, it's really used to help hide their infrastructure since this is a staged approach for delivery. And when those requirements are met, the JavaScript will load an iframe, which we rendered, showing that their user's browser or system is out of date. And upon clicking that on the compromised site, they'll be redirected to a stage 2 site, which will again have additional guardrails in check to, you know, mitigate, you know, the prompting of the actual payload. However, if those are met, and the user goes forward with downloading the fake update, a zip file will be dropped to disk. Opening that archive and, you know, clicking on the JavaScript file will launch WScript, the, you know, Windows script host, and it'll execute the payload. Upon executing that payload, C2 will be established with a stage 3 site where information collected from the system that it's infected will be relayed back via that channel. The information gathered is typically used to by the threat actor to understand what type of follow-on payload which will be delivered. If the system is not domain joined, we've typically seen net support rat as the follow-on payload. But if the infected host is domain joined, we typically see Cobalt Strike being delivered. So in this particular case, we identified a campaign that kind of hit a little, again, close to home, where many of our customers that we monitor were impacted by this campaign, two of which actually were an intrusion, others of which, you know, upon learning from our first two and the infrastructure that we were tracking, we were able to kind of mitigate, but we did identify, you know, communication with the infrastructure that we were tracking. So in this particular campaign, we identified the same infrastructure delivering or communicating to the stage 3 site. I checked last night and it looks like the infrastructure is still open. So we'll link the blog post that we're talking about here so you can kind of get some of those IOCs. But yeah, it started off with, again, like I said, two, and it grew to almost a dozen. And, you know, we've seen Sock Ghoulish for, you know, the last year, but this one in particular stood out because of just the reach it saw on the environments that ReliaQuest monitors. So, you know, we also tapped into our VT Enterprise subscription and found 21 payloads that were uploaded from around the world to kind of show its impact. But kind of going back to your original question of like, who's behind this? Well, at least speaking for the intrusions that we worked, the follow-on payloads were Cobalt Strike, and the team servers that the Cobalt Strike beacon was communicating with were tied to infrastructure that, you know, we assess with moderate confidence is tied to the notorious Evil Corp gang. And, you know, some of the actions that we saw following kind of help suggest and you know, help with the soft attribution that we've made on it being tied to Evil Corp.
That's really interesting. I seem to remember Evil Corp were associated with, in some reporting at least, I'm not sure of how confirmed this was or with what confidence they were associated with some of the Russian intelligence services, if I'm not mistaken, or at least some of their suspected members. Really interesting campaign and one that I very much thoroughly enjoyed reading and kind of working, you know, with your team. What was your experience in kind of tackling this new campaign? Were there any challenges or particular insights that might have taken you by surprise?
Yeah, so the intrusions that we worked. So there were a couple of notable findings, which we kind of highlight in the blog. But for the most part, it was, in the intrusions at least, very typical, ransomware affiliate type of operations, logging. I'm a huge log junkie, and logging is going to play a critical role here for detection and mitigation and obviously response. But of the notable things that, you know, we identified when analyzing and getting some of these forensics images of these machines was the use of the web utility. So that's like a utility that, you know, ships with Windows products. Windows machines, excuse me, and it's used by administrators to interact with ETW or, you know, Windows event logs. And in this case, what we noticed was what we typically notice web utility use for defense evasion purposes, you know, like time stomping or deleting of logs to kind of cover their trail. But in this case, what we found interesting was we noticed the adversary leverage WMIC to connect to a remote domain controller to then prompt and run WebUtil to gather the 4776 events out of the security logs on that domain controller. Those 4776 events are logged for anybody that has authenticated against the domain controller using NTLM. And they then stage that in a directory, which they pulled back later. We didn't see use of it. This is kind of where, we severed the foothold. But in this case, what was really interesting was how that utility was being used, as well as the purpose behind it. So we obviously, NTLM has a lot of vulnerabilities with it that are tied to it. And, you know, most notably, like pass the hash is something that you could use to facilitate via NTLM. So we kind of inferred from that sighting or operation that the threat actor was trying to obtain usernames or user accounts within the environment that had been authenticating via NTLM to facilitate a pass the hash attack or target those accounts to grab their NTLM hash to then, you know, do a pass the hash attack. And with that, like we kind of made that suspicion off another notable finding where we identified the threat actor disabling restricted admin mode on another endpoint kind of adjacent to the endpoint that we identified that. And restricted admin mode is essentially a guardrail that Microsoft introduced to prevent when individual RDPs to a machine from their credentials being stored on that machine in memory. So we know that, well, we infer from that, that the adversary was disabling that so that anybody that would RDP to that machine that they had a foothold on in the future, they would be able to retrieve those credentials and then facilitate a pass the hash attack via RDP. So those were, you know, probably the most notable findings that we saw. Again, we have never seen up to that point WebUtil being used in that way, but based on some of the other observations made, we, you know, predict with, or, you know, assess with high confidence that that was the intention of the adversary in that case.
That's super interesting. So it's a traditional combination of kind of older techniques, you know, using browser updates to get someone to interact, Cobalt Strike, but then also kind of having those newer techniques like you're referring to, like removing Windows controls related to RDP. That's super interesting. What should our listeners actually be doing to minimize the risk from this particular campaign?
Yeah, so one that I'm a favorite of, and you know my team as well, is setting a GPO within your organization to automatically run JavaScript files or direct them to open with Notepad, rather than, you know, if I'm running a JavaScript file or clicking on a JavaScript file, it's going to tap into WScript to launch it. So essentially creating that GPO so that when a user by mistake clicks on that payload that's delivered, it kind of renders the attack chain and makes it useless because the payload itself is not going to execute. Most environments, obviously, there's going to be some IT teams or security teams or, you know, systems administrators that are going to need JavaScript for something. But I'd say for the most part, you know, 80% of an enterprise environment, there's going to be no need for, you know, Mike in HR or, you know, Susan in marketing to interact with a JavaScript file. So if you can kind of create those based on roles or, you know, other AD objects that you can define that are not needed to run JavaScript, that's a really good control, specifically for Java, for SOC Ghoulish. As we know, SOC Ghoulish makes use of a JavaScript payload.
I would definitely spend a lot of time validating that, because, you know, and Brandon is obviously advocating for that as well, but, you know, we have enough challenges trying to defend networks as security practitioners. We don't need to cause more challenges ourselves and shoot ourselves in the foot, as it were. So if you do that, definitely test it, do it by groups, do some of the things that Brandon recommended. But yeah, you don't want to go about doing that hastily and make a mistake that causes more problems than you intend.
Yeah. And then on that note, like, just more agnostic, and it's really not on the mitigation front, but it's really to help defenders be able to identify and obviously respond to that as soon as possible. You know, as I mentioned, I'm a huge log junkie. Telemetry, security enriched telemetry is going to be vital in this case. So, you know, whether that's your EDR technologies or you know, even network telemetry, it's going to be very important here. So, you know, as we can see, WScript is the utility that's going to be used to execute the JavaScript. So monitoring for WScript launching, you know, JavaScript files that meet certain criteria. So in our case, update.js was the name of the payload. I'm sure there's, you know, GitHub repositories out there where you can kind of build a regular expression for, you know, WScript launching suspicious JavaScript files. Also the follow-on actions of, you know, whether that be Cobalt Strike. In this case, you know, we have high degree of confidence that obviously with the threat actor that we believe that was involved with this and their intention, you know, or their main goal here, we believe was to deploy ransomware, that human operation aspect comes into play. And, you know, they're going to move within the environment. They're going to take actions. They're going to be following their playbooks, and they're noisy, right? They do things that, you know, with the right controls in place, whether that be the EDR or using Sysmon or forwarding event logs to your SIM, you're going to see that stuff if you have the right detections in place. But again, if you do not, you're kind of just waiting for impact to be felt at that point. Obviously, also on the network aspect of it, you're going to have communication with multiple sites. Tracking the stage one site's a little bit more difficult. The stage two site also kind of difficult because of the guardrails, but the stage three site paired with threat intelligence, obviously, you know, ReliaQuest with our Foston research team, but whatever providing you're out there, I definitely would tap in to ask to make sure that they are up to date on the most recent SOC Ghoulish stage three sites. So you can kind of put controls in place to, you know, sinkhole if you're being proactive on traffic to those domains, as well as like Cobalt Strike infrastructure, since we see that as a follow-on. So making sure you have appropriate forward proxy logging, firewall, NetFlow, whatever you're using to build detections and build mitigation strategies on those types of infrastructure.
I'll add one other thing. Not necessarily specific to Sock Ghoulish, but don't let any of your web properties become a stage one site for somebody else to be used in the manner that WordPress was here. You know, you think of vulnerability on your website, then you start pushing some malicious actor's code. You can think Magecart as an example here. So keeping and managing, you know, having logs on all of your sites that you're running for customers or employees, anything that's public facing, making sure that you have the latest patches, be it WordPress or an Apache or an IIS, whatever the case may be. But yeah, don't become the stage one site that infects people, you know, from your infrastructure as well. So think of it that way too.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to become a part of the threat actor's infrastructure to impact somebody else, right? Anything else you want to add onto this one, Brandon?
No, yeah, that pretty much wraps it up. You know, we sum a lot of it up in the blog, but this was particularly interesting to us because, you know, we've seen firsthand a Sock Ghoulish infection lead to a ransomware deployment. So the threat is there. But again, we just, you know, wanted to highlight this because of the impact that we saw it within our customer environment. So wanted to share it with the greater community.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll make sure that the show notes are annotated with that particular blog. Like I said, very, very interesting case. I think just, also, you know, go on, sorry.
A shout out. No, I just wanted to give a shout out, you know, so Dean, Joe Morales also worked on this. Chris, you kind of assisted in this as well. So this is a nice team effort. And like, from my perspective, you know, going into the acquisition, I think this is a good example of us exposing more of the cool things that we're seeing inside ReliaQuest customers, layering in the external view on it as well. So I think it's pretty exciting content. And for all the listeners out there, there's going to be more of these types of work in the future. We're already working on the next one right now as well.
I was just going to say, yeah, that's, I probably can mention at the end the next kind of piece of work along these lines. Great stuff. All right, we'll wrap it up here. I think we've been going for almost an hour now, so quite a long podcast today. That's it for today. Thank you for all three of you for joining and contributing on today's podcast. I'll quickly mention the blogs we have coming out and that have just been released as well. So this week, we released a blog on unmasking various crypto scams in circulation. So really interesting piece and definitely want to check out if, like me, you're kind of interested in this space. And next week, we also have a blog reviewing the recent SANS CTI summit. So this one's going to be authored by Rick. You got any kind of comments you want to leave on this one, Rick, on the particular blog?
Boy, I better deliver it now. I have no choice. No more delaying on it. No, I helped run the SANS Cyber Threat Intelligence summit, and it was in DC last week. So I'm going to do a recap of it and point out some of the talks, where to go to find some of the content that came from it. So stay tuned for more middle of next week.
Good stuff. Okay, that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week.